The Triple Path by James Kenneth Rogers. Thanksgiving Tide 2023 Edition. Published by the Church of the West. Each who passed through this life, rich or poor, chose a path to walk till at death's door. You who yet breathe are still choosing yours. About the author. James Kenneth Rogers earned a Juris Doctor from Harvard Law School, a Master's of Law in International Law from the University of Cambridge, and a BA in International Relations with Honors from Brigham Young University. A sixth-generation Arizonan, he has lived on four continents. He has four children. His website and blog are at jameskennethrogers.com. Preface. When I was in my late 20s, I went through a process of questioning and soul-searching. My doubt led to introspection and study, and eventually to the collapse of my previous worldview and religious beliefs. In the depths of this crisis of faith, I could only define myself in negative terms, of what I was not and what I did not believe. I eventually realized that defining myself based on what I opposed was not spiritually and psychologically healthy, and was hindering my personal growth and search for meaning. I thus started trying to redefine myself and what I believed in terms of positives instead of negatives, to worry less about what is wrong and false and more about what is right and true. I found myself with a spiritual hunger that needed to be filled. I obtained spiritual nourishment from many places, but especially in the works of the Stoic philosophers and in the sacred texts of some of the major religions. I synthesized what I found into the Triple Path, which at its most basic, teaches us to seek wisdom, practice virtue, and labor with hope. I began this book to record what I was finding, mostly for myself and my children, to clarify for myself where I should be orienting my life, and to help guide my children on their own spiritual journeys. I originally conceived of the Triple Path as a supplement to religion, something one could use to add to one's practice of a faith that was otherwise lacking. I eventually came to see that practicing the Triple Path as an adjuvant to another religion I did not believe was not spiritually or morally sustainable. It was like seeking nourishment from old moldy bread while having all the necessary ingredients to bake new bread, formed after the manner of the old bread, of course. Or it was like trying to build a house on a foundation of sand. And so I decided to bake some new bread, or to start building on a firmer foundation. The Triple Path sets forth a new monotheistic religion that revives the most ancient branch of Christianity, adoptionism. It harmonizes and reconciles our great Western heritage with modernity, but with an emphasis on keeping as much as possible of the teachings and practices of Western tradition and faith. Its objective is to provide a practical approach for drawing closer to God and to living with more meaning, a virtuous, traditional, and spiritual life. The preamble section of this book, comprising four chapters, explains why we need religion and God, and why we now need the Triple Path. It also explores the concept of truth and different ways of discovering it, and principles of morality and ethics. The next section is meditations and parables. The first four chapters are meditations mostly in the second person, following the style of Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. They adapt the words of many great religious and philosophical thinkers, arranged by topic. The fifth chapter contains parables. The final section, Creed, Rites and Feasts and Practice, sets forth a creed, a description of church rituals and feasts, and a pattern for church organization and practice. In writing the Triple Path, I am not trying to assume the status of some sort of guru or sage. Indeed, I am skeptical of anyone who would hold himself out as such. I am trying hard to practice what I preach, but like all people, I fall short of my ideals. I have never made any profits off of this book. Electronic copies are free, and the price of hard copies is just above the break-even point, and does not generate enough revenue to offset costs such as for ISBNs and modest promotion efforts. I started this project in 2010. It has developed and grown gradually, like a medieval cathedral slowly rising. My regular process of adding and revising material will likely continue long into the future. Whenever an updated book edition is released, it will be named after the church feast falling closest in time to its release. You can always find the latest version for free at triplepath.org/download. James Kenneth Rogers. January 22, 2023. Part 1. Preamble. Note for preamble section of audiobook. To clarify, when text in this section is a direct quotation from an outside source, it will be read in a different narrator's voice.
This will be the narrator voice for all direct quotations.
Preamble. Chapter 1. Introduction. The West is increasingly giving up on religion. This is a problem. The United States remains the most religious of the developed countries, and even here, the percentage of the adult population claiming no religious affiliation has increased significantly, from 3% in 1957, to 8.2% in 1990, to 26% in 2019. The percentage of Americans self-identifying as Christian declined from 77 to 65% between 2009 and 2019. No affiliation is now the largest single religious group in America. Only 25% of Americans attend church regularly. Even those who claim affiliation with a particular religion are giving up on many of their religion's teachings. A survey of self-identified Catholics found that only 31% believed in the core Catholic doctrine of transubstantiation, that the bread and wine at Mass actually become the body and blood of Christ. The percentage of Americans who report having grown up with a father who was religiously active decreased from 70% for those born before 1900 to 45% for those born after 1970. According to one scholar,
every indicator of traditional religiosity is either stable or declining, and there isn't enough new non-traditional religious practice to balance the decline.
Secularization is happening even faster in Britain and Europe. Religion is part of human nature. It is found in all cultures worldwide, and appears to have been a constant part of our behavior going back at least many tens of thousands of years. There are different scientific explanations for how religion and our tendency for religious behavior developed. One explanation is that they directly evolved through natural selection. Another is that they came about as a cultural byproduct of mental modules, such as agency detection, that developed for other reasons. From a scientific, materialist viewpoint, the most reasonable explanation is that religion and religiosity likely developed through a combination of both factors, with religion initially developing as a cultural byproduct of non-religious mental modules, but with innate biological religious tendencies then developing and strengthening through gene culture coevolution. I believe there are also spiritual explanations for their development, and that God's influence was involved as well. Regardless of how they developed, religion and religiosity are a part of our humanity, and they are precious. Over tens of thousands of years, human cultures have accumulated and passed on to future generations much knowledge about morality and right living, about how to create and maintain good relationships and build successful communities, and about what a good life is and how to live it. The principles of morality and traditions that we have developed within the context of religion have enabled us to live in ever more complex and prosperous societies. Over the last 10,000 years, humans moved from living in simple hunter-gatherer tribes to agricultural societies of increasing complexity and size. The large and complex societies of the last few thousand years could not function without moral principles that were developed, honed, and promoted over the generations by religions. Principles such as charity, empathy, honesty, integrity, industriousness, discipline, sexual restraint, and respect for life and personal property. As more people have more fully lived these moral principles, their lives have significantly improved. Beyond just giving us moral principles, religion guides us on the path to meaning and illumination, supporting our search for answers to deep life questions and encouraging our individual personal development. It helps us to make parts of our lives sacred, and to feel like we are part of something bigger than ourselves in a way that is psychologically nourishing and revitalizing. It helps us draw closer to a higher power and feel serenity, peace, transcendence, elevation, awe, and gratitude. Religion also gives us outlets for exercising moral goodness towards others, and thus encourages stable, thriving communities. It gives us rites and ceremonies to provide meaning and mark major life events. It provides us with a sense of fellowship and unity with others. It encourages group cohesiveness and provides a social outlet for people to interact, become acquainted, learn from each other, and support one another in their lives and beliefs. And it provides a public signaling mechanism about our and others' devotion and trustworthiness. Most importantly, religion demands that we live better and become greater than we were, calling to us in unique and compelling ways that are often most apt to lead us to lasting change and progress. As William James wrote,
"The highest flights of charity, devotion, trust, patience, bravery to which the wings of human nature have spread themselves have been flown for religious ideals."
Almost every adaptive human trait, from altruism to anger, can become unbalanced, turn maladaptive, and lead to negative outcomes. Religion is no different. At least in Western society, however, there is hard evidence that religion is a net benefit. Scholars have found over and over that religiosity and belief in God are positively related to better physical and mental health, greater life satisfaction, longer lifespan, and prosocial behavior. The research strongly indicates that religiosity actually causes these effects. The weight of the evidence is astounding. If you have any doubt, please turn right now to the next chapter, God and Religion, Practical Evidence, starting on page 33, for a longer discussion, including many references to academic journals. For psychologically healthy and normal human beings, it is difficult for us to escape religiosity, no matter what church we do or do not go to. Whenever a group of people coalesces around strongly held beliefs or ideas, their religious natures usually emerge, whether it be around Christianity, atheism, social justice, environmentalism, or politics. Even those who formally reject organized religion or belief in God rarely escape their fundamental religious natures. They are still human beings, after all. Like most human traits, each person's innate religious tendencies probably vary along a bell curve. Just as some people are naturally angrier or happier than others, some are more religious than others. The distribution of a natural trait can change in a population over time, but a trend happening as swiftly as secularization in the West is most likely due to principally cultural forces. This is because there have not been enough generations for natural selection to have had much effect, and, if anything, is selecting in the long term for greater innate religiosity, since religiosity is a heritable trait and religious people in the West have higher fertility levels than the non-religious. Most people who claim no religious affiliation are thus likely doing so because of cultural trends and not because of an innate lack of a religious nature. One might argue that the growing numbers of people claiming no formal religious affiliation are doing so because they have a naturally diminished religious sense and are now giving up on religion because there are fewer cultural constraints against doing so. This is unlikely, however, because most of those who forsake formal religious affiliation continue to manifest an innate religious nature in other ways. Even atheist philosopher John Gray has noted that
secular thought is mostly composed of repressed religion.
Indeed, it is easy to see innate human religious tendencies manifest themselves among the ostensibly non-religious. New secularists often end up, usually unconsciously, dedicating their natural religiosity to things that scratch their religious itch, but that do not bring as many of the benefits of traditional religion. They are like someone trying to fulfill his body's craving for the wholesome nutrition of fresh, ripe fruit by eating a bag of candy. They devote themselves to things outside the realm of organized religion, but that are still just as strongly religious, albeit distorted and twisted. New kinds of superstitions and strange new modern secular orthodoxies lacking a basis in reality or tradition, and often with unanticipated harmful effects. For example, many modern secularists have transplanted Calvinist notions of original sin and predestination and superstitious notions of witchcraft and black magic into their conceptions of race, ethnicity, and gender relations. Many have transformed their zeal for religious orthodoxy into campaigns to universally impose their ideology, often by destroying the professional and social life of anyone who does not agree with them. Even though we have natural, innate behavioral tendencies and mental attributes that appear to be hardwired into us, they manifest within the context of the culture around us. Language is an innate human characteristic, but the specific language each person speaks is determined by the surrounding culture. When our culture fails to provide a viable option through which we can manifest our natural behaviors, we invent something. In Nicaragua in the 1980s, deaf children were brought together for the first time to attend a vocational school for the deaf. Teachers did not teach any kind of sign language, instead they tried unsuccessfully to teach Spanish and lip reading. The children, though, on their own, created their own sign language so they could communicate with each other. This sign language developed over time into a sophisticated and complete language. Similarly, when families from different cultures migrate to the same place, the adults usually create a pidgin, which is a simplified language that combines elements of the native languages of the people who created it. Pidgins allow for basic communication, but are not full languages. However, the children in such communities usually take their parents' pidgin and turn it into a grammatically and lexically complete language. This new language is called a Creole, and normally becomes the native language of the children and their descendants. Some linguists hypothesize that modern English itself is a Creole combining Germanic Old English with the Norman French brought by William the Conqueror. Left unchecked, the emerging religious orthodoxies and practices of the new secularists would likely develop into a full religion, just like sign language in Nicaragua and Creoles all over the world have developed into new, complete languages. Creoles can develop so quickly because they borrow heavily from the languages of the groups that came together to create them. Similarly, speakers of Nicaraguan Sign Language borrow from outside sources, such as American Sign Language, to fill in gaps. The secularists, however, seem eager to ignore and forget as much as they can of the rich religious and cultural heritage bequeathed to us by our ancestors. If the new religion they are slowly creating does not collapse, it will survive only at the cost of many years and likely generations of painful adjustment as they struggle to come up with new solutions to problems our ancestors already solved long ago. And those new solutions will almost certainly develop into moral values and rules that end up being not much different from the traditional moral values and rules the secularists had originally rejected. After the Western Roman Empire fell in 476 AD, the knowledge and capacity lost in fields such as science, engineering, and art were not redeveloped or rediscovered for many centuries, not until the 19th century for some things. Ice core samples that record historical levels of industrial pollution show that worldwide industrial production of copper, lead, and silver did not return to Roman levels until about the year 1600. Ancient Rome was the first city in the world to reach a population of 1 million. After Rome's fall, no Western city reached this size again until London in about the year 1800. The sophistication of the Roman financial system was not equaled again until the 17th and 18th centuries. Shipbuilding technology did not redevelop to the level of being able to build ships larger than Roman merchant ships until the 15th century, and not being able to exceed the size of Roman grain ships until the 19th century. The secularists' rejection of religion and tradition runs the risk of plunging us into an equivalent religious and spiritual dark age that could take centuries to climb out of. On the other hand, those who have given up on the established religions have some valid concerns. The major world religions are pre-modern creations. After taking into account modern scientific understandings, as well as recent textual, historical, and archaeological discoveries, many people now find it difficult to accept certain aspects of the established religion's factual claims. This is one of the main reasons why religious affiliation and participation is decreasing so significantly in the West. I address this book mainly to those who have lost their faith in traditional religion. I am one of you. If you are like me, you feel like you have lost something precious that used to bring value and meaning to your life. But what do we replace it with? The replacement non-believers most often seem to turn to is some form of nihilism or social justice grievance fanaticism, or often both. These are a poor substitute for the grandeur and hope and love and meaning and divine connection we get out of religion. This book offers a new religion that stays as faithful as possible to the wisdom and traditions of the past, while still embracing our modern historical and scientific understanding of the world. It offers a better substitute for the empty nihilism and totalitarian grievance activism that seem to be growing as replacements for traditional religion. If you do not have faith in the established religions, please continue on and see if you find something worth pursuing here. This book is not an attempt to criticize adherents of other religions or to claim that their beliefs are wrong. In fact, when it comes to moral and spiritual truths, truths about being, meaning, and action, this book argues that the beliefs of the established religions are more true than what secular modernism teaches. The focus of this book is to encourage faith in God, not to tear it down. Its purpose is to show that you can build up a strong and solid spirituality that is still compatible with modern rational modes of thinking and with our factual understanding of the world around us. Thus, to the faithful of other religions, I invite you also to read on and see if you find something of value in these pages. This book contains no detailed polemical attacks about specific religious belief. The next 5 paragraphs are the only ones that even touch on such issues, and only offer a mild, general explanation about why many people now find it hard to believe in established religions. The purpose of those paragraphs is not to take a side in a religious debate, but to make sure both sides can understand where the other is coming from. So why do many people now have a hard time relying on the established religions? Many teachings of the established religions are based on pre-modern cosmologies. Cosmology means our understanding of the universe and humanity's place in it, that make factual claims that can appear to contradict our scientific understanding of the world. They are also mixed with seemingly legendary retellings of history that can be difficult to take literally. Many people perceive these ancient cosmologies and histories as having ever-decreasing relevance in their day-to-day lives. For example, when the great world religions were founded, many of those religions' adherents believed the world was flat and was at the center of the universe. The most common cosmology in the Bible presupposes the earth is a flat disk floating in water or supported by pillars. Other biblical writers say the earth is immovable and everything else, including the sun, revolves around it. For biblical writers, hell was a literal place below the ground, and heaven was a literal place just above the earth. In different places in the Bible, the reason the sky is blue is either because we are seeing a heavenly ocean suspended above the sky, or because the sky is the sapphire floor of heaven. Even if hell might not literally exist below us, and heaven not literally be in the sky, I believe that heaven and hell are real in a spiritual sense. Like me, most modern readers now interpret many of these types of Bible passages spiritually or metaphorically. But even so, it appears the writers of these passages probably intended them to be interpreted as being literally true. Many people who read the Bible nowadays perceive some of its stories as reading more like mythology than literal history. And if you try to look at things from the perspective of an unbeliever, you might understand why they have a hard time believing stories about talking serpents and donkeys, or about a man emerging unharmed 3 days after being swallowed by a giant fish, or tales of holy men calling fire from the sky, summoning a bear to kill youths who had mocked his baldness, or stopping the progression of the sun through the sky. Because the world's established religions rest on foundations that many people increasingly perceive as more legendary than factual, many individuals now find those religions' claims implausibly difficult to accept. As a result, participation is declining in most religions as they are forced to confront modernity. If Western civilization needs traditional religion to survive, but traditional religion cannot thrive in the modern world and thus cannot fulfill its important historical role, what are we to do? How should we react when we are confronted with modernity-induced religious doubts? Let us consider 4 possible responses: 1. The literal approach, 2. The symbolic approach, 3. The rejection approach, and 4. The triple path. The literal approach. If history and modern cosmology contradict sacred texts, one approach is to reject history and modern cosmology. This is hard to justify, though, based on a dispassionate weighing of the evidence. Even so, religious believers who take a literal approach sometimes justify this approach by appealing to authority and arguing that their scriptures, or the pronouncements of leaders who claim to speak on God's behalf, contain the Word of God and are thus the ultimate authority, trumping the pronouncements of fallible humans. There are several problems with this approach to relying on authority. Believing in the divine authority of teachers or texts merely because they claim divine authority is circular. We have no reason to believe in their claims to divine authority unless we already accept their teachings. Merely claiming authority offers no external reason to believe in that authority. Believing in the literal, factual truth of a leader's or a text's divine authority because of our subjective emotional responses to them is almost equally questionable. Spiritual feelings are subjective. Adherents of wildly different religions, religions with contradictory and mutually exclusive teachings, describe the same sorts of spiritual feelings confirming their belief in these religions. For a much more in-depth discussion of this phenomenon and a more general discussion on how we can find truth, see the third chapter, Some Thoughts on Truth, starting on page 49. Some followers may instead place their trust in stories about a teacher's or a leader's miraculous or supernatural abilities. These stories, if true, might provide some indication of divine authority, but they often seem to end up failing objective verification. Often, they are told second or third hand, or the miraculous occurrence ends up being explained by charlatanism. Many such stories do not stand up to rigorous scrutiny. And even if a story does stand up to scrutiny, it does not necessarily prove that the miracle in question came from God. Even a legitimate miracle might have a non-divine explanation, such as psychic ability or even a connection to evil spiritual forces, as the Apostle Paul said.
Even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light.
Things like feelings, stories of unknown veracity, or a religious text's or leader's own claim to authority are not enough to validate claims about the religious text's or teacher's authority, especially for claims that are directly contradicted by historical or archaeological evidence or by our modern scientific observations of the world. Furthermore, it is a logical fallacy to believe in a statement's truth merely because it was uttered by an authority. Statements of authorities should be able to stand up to criticism and independent verification. We discuss this fallacy more on pages 58 to 59. Questions involving religion and the supernatural are hard to verify. Moreover, there are different standards of truth by which we can judge such claims. One kind of truth is factual truth about the material world, but another kind is truth about being and meaning. This second type of truth tells us about how we should act and be in the world, moral and spiritual truth. If an authority's statements about facts and history are true, they should be consistent with our knowledge of reality. Religious authorities have sometimes had a poor track record on getting factual truth right, but they have a much better track record on moral and spiritual truths. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 10 verse 16 that we must be wise like serpents, yet still innocent as doves. This is good advice in many contexts, including when trying to discern truth from error. There is a lot of spiritual and moral truth in traditional religious teachings. Thus, it would be foolish to reject everything that religion can teach us, just because it sometimes might get its facts wrong. It is also unwise, however, to accept without question every factual or historical or even moral claim taught by a religious teacher. Accepting without question all claims of traditional religion is being all dove, with no serpent. It just doesn't work. The opposite approach, though, of being all serpent and no dove, also doesn't work. The rejection approach. The rejection approach is to conclude that if verifiable religious claims are often contradicted by scientific discoveries, then perhaps there is not much reason to believe in any religious teaching or ideal. If the verifiable claims are untrue, then the unverifiable claims and teachings probably are not true or worth following either. A rejectionist might conclude that if the ancients were wrong about their cosmological claims, we should therefore reject, or be skeptical of, all traditional religious morals and injunctions, unless we can immediately find a good reason to keep them. The general presumption of rejectionists is guilty until proven innocent. All aspects of religion are valueless until proven otherwise. This is the approach most atheists seem to take. The problem with this approach is that it ignores our own short-sightedness. Often, it is hard to understand the reason for a traditional rule or taboo until long after the fact. For example, during the sexual revolution of the 1960s and 1970s, it was assumed there was little justification for traditional sexual norms and that they should be abandoned. It turns out, though, that those traditional sexual norms encourage behaviors that are associated with stable family structures and thus better outcomes for children in our society, and eventually for the future of society itself. They also encourage actions more likely to lead to a life richer with meaning, and they discourage actions that are psychologically and spiritually harmful. Sexual promiscuity appears to exact a tremendous negative emotional toll, particularly on women. Couples who do not live together before marriage, and in which the woman was a virgin on her wedding night, have much lower risk of divorce. And divorce is associated with a host of poor outcomes for children. Comparative anthropological research suggests that widespread cultural acceptance of norms of strict chastity before marriage and absolute monogamy afterwards leads to positive societal outcomes as well. One lifetime is not long enough to figure everything out. That is why we have culture and tradition. Wisdom about how to live accumulates slowly over huge spans of time and gets passed down as tradition. Rejecting all of it or large parts of it is an unwise course. It is far safer only to reject the hard-earned wisdom of the past when it has been clearly and indisputably proved wrong. Moreover, religion provides important structure and discipline on which to build your life and character. It is difficult to get this structure and discipline in any other way. As Professor Jordan Peterson wrote,
"Religion is about proper behavior. It's about what Plato called the good. A genuine religious acolyte isn't trying to formulate accurate ideas about the objective nature of the world, although he may be trying to do that too. He's striving instead to be a good person. It may be the case that to him good means nothing but obedient, even blindly obedient. Hence the classic liberal Western Enlightenment objection to religious belief: obedience is not enough. But it's at least a start, and we have forgotten this. You cannot aim yourself at anything if you are completely undisciplined and untutored. You will not know what to target, and you won't fly straight, even if you somehow get your aim right. And then you will conclude, there is nothing to aim for. And then you will be lost. It is therefore necessary and desirable for religions to have a dogmatic element. What good is a value system that does not provide a stable structure? What good is a value system that does not point the way to a higher order? And what good can you possibly be if you cannot or do not internalize that structure or accept that order, not as a final destination necessarily, but at least as a starting point? Without that, you're nothing but an adult two-year-old, without the charm or the potential. That is not to say it again, that obedience is sufficient. But a person capable of obedience, let's say instead a properly disciplined person, is at least a well-forged tool. At least that, and that is not nothing. Of course, there must be vision beyond discipline, beyond dogma. A tool still needs a purpose. It is for such reasons that Christ said in the Gospel of Thomas, "The kingdom of the Father is spread out upon the earth, but men do not see it."
The symbolic approach. The symbolic approach is to accept current religions as they are, but reinterpreting many of their teachings as being merely symbolic. It focuses on symbolism and allegory as powerful tools for teaching and helping us to feel moral truths. The conservative variety of this approach is to reject only the parts of a religion's teachings that are indefensible, but to retain everything else and hold fast to the old religion. You take teachings about cosmology that have been contradicted by modern science and reinterpret them as symbolic, but you continue believing in the teachings that have not yet been challenged by science. You create space for belief out of the gaps that science has not or cannot address. Thus, you might discount the idea of a creation in 6 days, but continue believing that God created the earth using natural processes over millions of years. If heaven is not directly above the earth, it is somewhere else, or on another plane of existence. This conservative approach of discarding the bare minimum is far preferable to the rejection approach. The problem with it, though, is that as scientific and historical knowledge seem to contradict more and more aspects of traditional religion, its foundations continue to weaken. This is because those foundations appear increasingly to rest on cosmologies and historical claims whose factual basis is now doubted, even though originally those foundations were firmly grounded on the premise that they were literally true. The liberal variety of this approach is to reject or ignore any teaching that seems out of date or out of harmony with the spirit of the times. You reinterpret as symbolic anything you want. The problem with being this liberal is that religious belief becomes volatile and ever-changing. Groups made up of individuals who apply a liberal approach often lack internal consistency and have little to unite them. Some people adopt a symbolic approach privately, while maintaining membership in a religion that asserts cosmologically or historically suspect teachings as true. There are cultural and social reasons to do this. If you live in a society or within a group dominated by a certain religion, you may have no practical choice but to remain affiliated and try to make the best of what you have. This is not a wise or sustainable solution, however. It is morally degrading to live such a double spiritual life, and is difficult to do so without being dishonest. Furthermore, continuing participation in such religions provides them with greater institutional strength, which helps them perpetuate false beliefs. The liberal variety of this approach often means joining a liberal religion that endorses the symbolic approach, whether officially or de facto, by rejecting the literal truth of many of its foundational spiritual beliefs and texts. In theory, this might sound like a promising way forward, but in practice it has proved to be a dead end. Churches generally adopt this approach while still relying on their previous forms of worship and holy texts. Doing this requires a great deal of organizational dishonesty, maintaining an overt devotion to many aspects of the religion that are based on things the religion has also already partially or completely rejected. Such dishonesty is poison to the moral character of an organization or person. Applying a "by their fruits you will know them" test shows that the churches that have adopted the liberal symbolic approach are generally failures. Such churches usually do not stop only at rejecting old, seemingly false cosmologies, but continue on to also jettison many valuable, foundational moral teachings. They give up not only on the discredited parts of their beliefs, but on tried and true traditions too, often to the point of almost becoming outright rejectionist. This illustrates the greatest problem with the liberal variety of the symbolic approach: it rejects too much. Ever-declining attendance at such churches is a concrete manifestation of the morally bankrupt, dead husk most of them have become. By itself, a middle-of-the-road symbolic approach is an important tool for getting the most out of religion. The stories and teachings passed down to us over generations and through the centuries have survived so long for a reason. They are powerful stories illustrating profound moral and psychological truths, and the symbolic approach is the best way to take them to heart. Psychology professor Jordan Peterson has produced a marvelous lecture series discussing the psychological significance and symbolic meaning of major Bible stories. These lectures are well worth studying, and are a great example of how the symbolic approach can point us toward wisdom and add rich meaning to our lives. But the way things are now, applying the symbolic approach to traditional religion can often be like treating skin cancer with sunblock. Even the conservative, traditional religions are shrinking as people lose faith in them. Most cosmologically suspect religious teachings were originally put forth as being literally true, even if they also were originally intended to have, or were later rewritten to have, multiple symbolic meanings. Of course, there are some exceptions. Jesus' parables are profound and full of meaning, but were not taught as being literally true. The legendary stories of the Bible and the pre-modern assumption that they were literally true formed the traditional foundation of religion in the West. Symbolically reinterpreting them, whether in a conservative or liberal way, cannot avoid the irreparable damage the foundations have already suffered from scientific and historical discoveries indicating that most of them are not factually true. If conservative symbolic and literalist churches are facing long-term decline, and if liberal symbolic and rejectionist churches have fared even worse, then maybe we need another solution. We need new, strong religious foundations that do not rely on every religious story being literally true. Then we can continue to draw meaning and learn important lessons from them and all the other parts of traditional religion, without them undermining the foundations of our civilization. The Triple Path Approach. If the previous approaches do not work, then how can we preserve, honor, and practice the valuable traditions, morals, and stories of our culture? The most important, fundamental purpose of religion is not providing a set of facts and propositions about the material world. Instead, the most fundamental purpose of religion is to provide guidance about how to structure your life and how to find meaning, about establishing a connection with the divine. And ideally, this all happens within the context of a community of like-minded people who help and support each other. The problem is that the symbolic and archetypal value of our religious traditions and stories are tied too closely to their cosmological and historical claims. When someone perceives a religion's factual claims as having been discredited, this pulls down the moral and spiritual claims too, like concrete shoes dragging someone underwater. Much of what was once in the realm of the unexplained is now understood. This has caused ever greater divergences between many religious teachings on factual matters and what we now understand about the material world. We need a fresh start to reset these divergences, using the good things from the past to build a new religion free of the non-essential stumbling blocks that are causing so many people to give up on religion. We need something that can integrate our modern understanding of the universe into the traditions and morals of the past, something conservative and traditional, but that is able, when needed, to change in response to new discoveries. With a new theological foundation not reliant on the literal truthfulness of legendary stories, we can maintain the traditions and morals of the past, and also more successfully apply the symbolic approach to continue cherishing and learning from the important heritage of our ancestors' traditions and culture. Until now, the only main alternative to traditional religious practice was to integrate into the new, coalescing religion of secularism. The Triple Path offers a different option, rejecting neither tradition nor modernity. It preaches a new monotheistic and Christian faith that, at its most basic, teaches us to seek wisdom, practice virtue, and labor with hope. Seeking wisdom means searching for the truth, not just to learn it, but also to figure out how to learn it. It means having the humility to acknowledge human limitations and to accept truth wherever you find it. It means developing better judgment and character. It means cultivating a calm and still mind, unmoved by the distractions of life and opinion. And it means doing everything you can to improve your ability to understand God, live under the influence of His divine light, and seek greater union with Him. Practicing virtue means living morally, doing good, desiring to do good, and doing it for the right reasons. It means working to be more like God and justified before Him. Laboring with hope is an extension of practicing virtue. It means actively working even in desperate times to make things better, starting first with yourself and your family. The Church of the West is the name of the church for those who follow the Triple Path. A summary of our beliefs and practices is on page 445, which contains our 19-paragraph creed. Or even better, you can read the rest of this book and become fully acquainted with the Triple Path and the rituals and church organization it sets forth. Its moral and ethical foundations are built from the wisdom of Christianity and Stoicism, seasoned with modern insights from psychology and other schools of classical thought, and with some added bits from Buddhism, Taoism, and other world philosophical and religious traditions. It is a religion focused more on developing moral character and wisdom instead of on superstition, but without ignoring the importance of spiritual and mystical truth and practice. Its cosmological foundations are in harmony with modern science and adaptable to future discoveries. Its theology is theistic rationalism. Its rituals are based on the Anglican Book of Common Prayer and on Western traditional practices, with influences also from Mormonism. Its relatively decentralized ecclesiastical and congregational structure combines elements from the Anglican, Methodist, and Mormon churches. Clergy and leadership are lay members chosen through sortition and who serve temporary terms of service. And it is unapologetically traditional, supporting time-honored morals and gender roles. Like all religions, the Church of the West has rules for anyone wanting to be a member. A thriving religion must make demands of its adherents. There are several reasons for this: to give adherents a sense of meaning and belonging, to generate a feeling of group identity, to make the religion a valued part of daily life — we do not value things that are easy or free — to teach the importance of sacrifice through lived experience, and to provide a signaling mechanism within the community that adherents can use to demonstrate to others their devotion to the religion's principles and to evaluate others' devotion. Religions develop their own unique rituals, traditions, and norms that set them apart from other groups. Some of these rituals, traditions, and norms do not have a strong moral component, but instead help ensure conformity with community standards and create a feeling of unity and usness. These norms of cohesion are rules or expectations that are based less on fundamental principles of morality and more on behavior rules that help members of a community establish their separate identity. These practices serve an important unifying purpose, because these norms of cohesion impose costs in time and foregone benefits. Following them provides a way to signal to other group members one's commitment to the group and to its moral principles. They act as powerful, concentrated symbols for the entire set of beliefs and practices of the religion. They serve as outward symbols of adherents' level of commitment to God and their coreligionists. We should take care to not confuse symbols with the things they are representing, but even so, the outward symbols and practices are still important in themselves. Such outward signals of commitment make it easier for group members to spot potential free riders who, not being committed to the group or to its moral teachings, will be less willing to follow norms of cohesion that impose costs, and to judge who is worthy of trust and inclusion in the group. The evidence shows that demanding norms of cohesion strengthen a group, and thus also strengthen cooperation and relationships between members of the group. Religious communes that have more demanding norms of cohesion last longer than those that do not. You are not committed to something unless you are willing to sacrifice for it, and no religion can thrive, or even survive, without committed members. Who would want to be a member of a religion full of lackadaisical and lukewarm adherents? Even more importantly, as Professor Jordan Peterson has said, we come into life with an ethical burden to justify our own existence. Life's purpose is not to maximize the ratio of personal pleasure or happiness to suffering, but to take on honorable, worthy challenges and sacrifice to overcome them. Such challenges, voluntarily undertaken, mold and shape us. They bring nobility of soul and allow us to accomplish great things. Self-denial and sacrifice in the context of religious practice, when properly undertaken, help develop this mature, courageous character. That is why all great religions demand sacrifices. The purpose of religion is not just to make you feel good or inspired. It is also to demand that you change for the better, and to show you the path to making those changes. Most of the demands the Church of the West makes of its adherents are standard moral rules found in most religions, but it also has unique rules that have the specific intent of setting adherents apart, just as in many other strong, cohesive religions, such as the Jewish prohibition on pork, the Mormon prohibition on alcohol and coffee, and the Catholic prohibition of meat on Fridays. Religious rules fall along a spectrum between serving a moral purpose and a cohesion purpose. Numbers 11 through 14 of the Creed, found on page 446, list the practices, rites, and feasts for adherents of the Triple Path. The most cohesion-targeted rule listed in the Creed is a prohibition on eating gluten. Its purpose is only for signaling and group cohesion. The rule is easy enough that anyone determined to follow it can do so without much disruption, but hard enough that few people will follow it unless they have a real commitment to the religion. Other major specific rules are more obviously moral, the best examples being the requirements to love others and follow the Golden Rule, and for celibacy before marriage and fidelity afterwards. Other rules listed in the Creed fall somewhere between the two poles of strictly moral and strictly cohesion-based rules. Some of these rules are maintaining Sunday as a day of rest, spiritual focus, and family, free from work and spending of money, completely abstaining from tobacco, drinking alcohol only in moderation, eating in a healthy and moderate manner, and exercising to keep our bodies fit and strong, avoiding excessive consumption of caffeine and refined sugar, and participating in the religion's rites and feasts, which are set out starting on page 449. The conservative approach, inherent in the triple path, of creating a new religion that also preserves as much of the West's religious traditions as possible, is because it can be hard to discern right away which parts of a religion are valuable. Often, traditions, rules, practices, and beliefs develop and last, even though no one would have consciously created them, because they confer some benefit that is not readily ascertainable. If a common traditional Western religious practice is not demonstrably untrue or harmful, then we should be very slow to discard it, even if it appears to serve no purpose. It may have value, or serve a purpose that is not immediately discernible. The Church of the West most assiduously tries to follow this when it comes to morals, practices, rites, and rules, and less so with cosmological claims, for reasons we have talked about earlier in this chapter. Followers of the Triple Path worry less about difficult-to-answer metaphysical questions like the nature of the soul, our fate after death, or future eternal rewards or punishments. In Matthew, Jesus says,
"Do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will bring worries of its own. Today's trouble is enough for today."
Triple Path adherents take Jesus at his word. We care more about the here and now than we do about abstract, indistinct, and indiscernible futures. We begin our approach to morality by seeking to do what is right because it is right, not because of some expected reward. Some might claim that good behavior is not enough, and that you also have to be baptized a certain way or adhere to some particular religion's rites and beliefs. But how can we know which religion's claims are right? The potential salvific value of most religions' practices and sacred rites are usually claimed to be exclusive. You have to practice that religion, and only that religion, to be saved. If only the rituals of a certain religion provide salvation, then we are faced with the nearly impossible task of trying to sort through an almost endless number of religions and churches to figure out which one is correct. It is far more sensible to focus on virtuous living and seeking a direct connection to God. If salvific rites, membership in a certain religion, or having the right beliefs were what God really required of us to receive salvation, I cannot help wondering if He would have made it clearer and easier to figure out which were the right ones. It makes far more sense that all of these are inventions of men to help us in our quest to draw closer to God and understand our place in the universe. The Triple Path teaches that we should be humble about what we know, or what we think we know. We should retain as much as we can of the beliefs of our ancestors, but we should also recognize that sometimes we may need to change our beliefs in the face of new evidence, proven discoveries, or better information. Such change should come only after long and careful examination, and usually only for indisputably proven matters of cosmology, science, and history. In matters of traditions, morals, and practices, change should be even slower and more rare, because innovations in such matters are far more likely to make things worse. Even in our modern age, we should not limit religion to being just an empirically based, scientific undertaking. Indeed, it would be foolish to do so. Finding beauty and meaning in life are important too. Religion helps us cultivate a sense of wonder and peace, an understanding of our human frailties and imperfections, resilience and meaning in the face of tragedy and suffering, and a respect for the mysteries of the universe. Human reason and rationality have been responsible for amazing advances in our culture, knowledge, and standards of living. But our minds are finite and surprisingly predisposed to irrationality. What this means is that all of us, even the most intelligent and rational among us, have hidden biases and predispositions that we cannot perceive. This is true for both religious believers and non-believers alike. Following the Triple Path means trying to clarify your thinking and act more rationally, but also means having humility about your conclusions and beliefs, not losing sight of the importance of feelings and human relationships, and showing ultimate respect and reverence for the divine by seeking the transcendent, ineffable experience of directly communing with God. The Codex. In the Creeds, Rites, and Practices section of this book, you will find occasional references to something called the Codex, which is another book that will be a companion volume to this one. The Codex will apply the symbolic approach to continue cherishing and learning from the important stories of our culture without requiring belief they are literally true by collecting them into one place, stories from the Bible, including the entire New Testament, Greco-Roman and Germanic myths, and medieval legends. The Codex is still only in very rough draft form. You can find the latest draft at triplepath.org/codex. Theism. If the Triple Path rejects disproved cosmologies, then why still believe in God? Current scientific models give us tremendous insight into how the universe began and how it works, and into the origins of mankind. These models, however, also have significant gaps and cannot explain the root cause of many scientific observations. Why did the Big Bang happen? How and why do the fundamental forces work? How and why do the elementary particles exist? How does consciousness work? What is consciousness? We at best have only incomplete answers to these questions. These gaps and unanswered questions leave room for belief in things that exist beyond the material world we perceive. The unanswered questions of science are known unknowns, they are things that we know that we do not know. These known unknowns already leave room open for the possibility of belief. But it would be wise to have the epistemological humility to also recognize the possibility of unknown unknowns, things that we do not even know that we do not know. The inherent limitations of our senses, our scientific instruments, and our minds leave open the possibility that there are realities beyond what we can perceive and measure, things we are incapable of even understanding. Indeed, it is impossible to prove or disprove the existence of God as he is often described in the monotheistic faiths, an invisible, all-powerful, all-knowing being who is present everywhere. Having this epistemological humility leaves still greater room, even for the most rationally minded person, to believe in the existence of God. With that room left open for belief, though, the question still remains, why believe? Many people do so after their own personal encounter with the divine. I write more on this in the third chapter, but there are other reasons for believing in God as well. Like William James, you can root it in pragmatic concerns. Just as there is a relationship between well-being and religiosity, there is also a relationship between belief in God and well-being, both physical and mental. People who believe in God are healthier, happier, live longer, and act more morally. As with the research on religiosity, the evidence is compelling. Once again, if you have any doubt, please turn right now to the next chapter, God and Religion, Practical Evidence, starting on page 33, for a longer discussion, including many references to peer-reviewed academic journals. Based on what we can measure about belief in God, deciding on theism makes sense. If the question of God's existence is fundamentally unprovable, but belief in him brings such positive results, then the rational response is to believe in God. And if your experience is like mine, if you let your rationality lead you to seek him out, and once you encounter him for yourself, you will come to see that religion and belief in God are much more than just cold, utilitarian pursuits, but that they can illuminate your life and kindle a transcendent, divine flame in your soul, that they are of the greatest intrinsic worth. Yet, the world's major religions can sometimes teach very different things about God. Looking more granularly, individuals' conceptions and definitions of God often seem as varied as the number of people holding them. How can we meaningfully discuss the question of God's existence and his characteristics if we do not even have a coherent definition of what he is? Indeed, people with mutually contradictory belief systems claim the same sorts of spiritual divine feelings as confirmation of the truth of their beliefs about God. So what does this mean? It might mean that there is one true religion and all the rest are false, and thus that the spiritual experiences of those religions' members are false. Or it might mean that there is no God. We favor a different explanation. Our explanation is twofold. First, that we often have a hard time hearing God and understanding him. As Paul says in the Bible,
we see through a glass darkly.
Second, we believe that God wants us to figure many things out for ourselves. We believe that it is impossible to fully define God with words. Each person must experience God for themselves. This is each person's right and solemn responsibility. It is your right and responsibility. It is less important to define God with precision than it is to personally encounter Him and thus come to a greater understanding of Him for yourself. The Triple Path's conception of God is best described as theistic rationalism. We believe that rationalism and religion can be compatible. We can commune and communicate with God, but He puts us in control of our actions and thus also responsible for their consequences. We pray to God to express our gratitude, goals, and desires. Maybe we even pray for miracles, but we believe that the outcomes of our lives are usually the result of our actions, natural laws, random chance, and the choices of others. We thus believe that misfortune and suffering can happen for the same reasons. Christianity. The Church of the West is a Christian church. We are a revival of the most ancient branch of Christianity, Adoptionism. The New Testament is part of our scriptures, the full text of it is contained in the Codex. There is spiritual power in the New Testament. That spiritual power is likely one of the main reasons why literally billions of people, over the course of thousands of years, have called themselves Christians. If you have never done so, I suggest you read the New Testament with an open heart and see what you find there. Like Thomas Jefferson, though, we believe that some passages of the New Testament are legendary accounts that might not be factually or historically accurate. We study the New Testament as one source of spiritual truth and not as a history textbook. We accept the historical reality of Jesus' life and crucifixion, something all mainstream Bible scholars also accept. We also believe that for many aspects of his story, it is impossible to separate legend from history. Generally, however, we assume that events in the past proceeded in conformity with natural law in the same way they do today. We therefore believe Jesus likely was born to two human parents, like every other human being. Most Christian churches are Trinitarian. They teach the doctrine of the Trinity, which holds that God, Jesus, and the Holy Ghost are co-equal, co-eternal, and thus not created, and consubstantial, and thus of the same substance. Like Sir Isaac Newton, we are not Trinitarians. We do not believe that Jesus was God or co-equal with Him. Nor do we believe that Jesus is co-eternal or consubstantial with God in some special way. Instead, we believe we can understand Jesus as having been adopted by God as His Son. Thus, we are adoptionist Christians. Adoptionism is a belief that goes all the way back to the earliest days of Christianity. It holds that Jesus was born as a human being like any other, but that He was adopted by God as His Son. There is support for this in the New Testament itself, suggesting that many early Christians were also adoptionists. The earliest Gospel, Mark, does not describe a virgin birth, nor do any of the writings of the Apostle Paul. And in several ancient manuscripts of Luke chapter 3 verse 22, at the baptism of Jesus, the voice from heaven does not say the more familiar,
"You are my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased."
Instead, the voice says,
"You are my Son, today I have begotten you."
If Jesus was only begotten on that day, then it means He was not the Son of God at His birth, He must have been adopted later. It is likely that this adoptionist version of the text of Luke is the original version. Indeed, Acts chapter 13 verse 33, Hebrews chapter 1 verse 5, and chapter 5 verse 5 all also appear to endorse adoptionism, either in connection with Jesus' baptism or crucifixion, and use the same language, which originates from Psalm chapter 2 verse 7, as the alternate reading of Luke, repeating it word for word.
"You are my Son, today I have begotten you."
Whatever the literal historical truth might be, we believe we can look to the story of Jesus' life as an example for us to follow. We thus accept Jesus Christ as our Savior, by virtue of His teachings and the archetype of His life as recounted in the Gospels. Accordingly, we seek to follow His example, so that we might also be united to God and adopted as His sons and daughters, just as Bible stories and early Christian doctrine taught that Jesus was adopted. This is similar to the Orthodox Christian concept of theosis, which holds that we can achieve union with God by purifying our body, mind, and soul, and by being illuminated with God's light. We believe that the path to theosis and to adoption by God is by seeking wisdom, practicing virtue, and laboring with hope. And thus the second paragraph of our creed states the following.
We accept Jesus Christ as our Savior, by virtue of his teachings and the archetypal example of his life as recounted in the Gospels. We believe that Jesus was adopted by God as his Son, and we seek to follow his example, so that we might also be united to God and adopted as his sons and daughters.
I explore these concepts more, along with other ideas related to spirituality, mysticism, and cosmology, in another companion volume to this one called The Spiritual Sense, which is still in draft form. You can read the latest version for free at triplepath.org/thespiritualsense. Conclusion. Our simple belief in God leaves open many questions about life, existence, and the supernatural. Those questions are important, but finding answers is hard. For many of them, finding answers in this life may be impossible. The seeming lack of certain answers is not a reason to reject the good that comes from believing in God and practicing religion. The Buddhist parable of the arrow helps explain why. This is my adaptation of it.
A man was shot with a poisoned arrow. As he lay injured, his family and friends brought a doctor to him to remove the arrow and administer an antidote for the poison. The man stopped the doctor, saying, "I will not have this arrow removed until I know the surgical technique to be used, until I know whether he who wounded me was wealthy or poor, well-liked or unpopular, sane or crazy, powerful or impotent. I will not have it removed until I know the name of he who wounded me, until I know whether he was tall or short, dark or pale, blonde or brown-haired, until I know whether his eyes were blue, brown, green or grey, until I know his city, state and country, until I know the language he speaks, until I know whether the bow firing the arrow that wounded me was a long bow or a crossbow, until I know what kind of fiber the bowstring was made of, and until I know whether the arrow shaft was wood, bamboo or reed." His family begged him to at least receive an injection of the antidote. He said, "I will not receive an antidote to the poison until I know whether the poison is natural or man-made, until I know whether it was derived from animal, plant, fungus or mineral, until I know whether it is acid or base, until I know how much poison has entered my bloodstream, until I know the lethal dosage of the poison, until I know the composition of the antidote, and until I know the amount to be administered to me." The man died, and all those things about which he had questioned still remained unknown to him. Indeed, for those around him with the tools to save him, his family, friends, and doctor, the answers to many of his questions were as much mysteries to them as they were to him. And even for the answers they did have, there was not enough time to explain them before the arrow and poison killed him.
Rationalism, empiricism, and pragmatic concerns are important, but so are the subjective, emotional, and spiritual side of things. Religion, God, and tradition add color and meaning to life. They can bring peace and a feeling of connection to something greater than yourself. They are the most important ends to seek after. Our time on this earth is limited. Even if we do not understand what they mean or how they work, it makes little sense to reject religion, God, and the traditions of our forefathers if they can help us be better, do better, and find meaning. Yet, in the midst of practicing our faith and traditions, there is nothing wrong with seeking greater understanding of what they mean and why they work, and if we exercise extreme humility and proceed very cautiously, we might even be able to successfully explore how they can be improved. Do not worry so much about getting the answers to all of life's questions right away. There are more important things to focus on first. Instead, worry about removing the poisoned arrows of selfishness, hypocrisy, ignorance, foolishness, evil, and lazy despair from your life. The evidence shows that religion and God can help you do that. And that is good enough. So read on and learn about the Triple Path. Try following it. Test its fruits for yourself. Come back to religion and God. Preamble.